The following program is presented by the Far East Broadcasting Company because stories of people living out the gospel with their lives inspire all of us. FEBC, taking Christ to the world through radio and new media. Learn more at febc.org.
When I was a missionary, I took with me the complete works of Jonathan Edwards and nothing else. And so I just read Edwards cover to cover. There were lots of moments when I was reading his sermons for academic work and just sensing I was meeting with the Lord and God was ministering to me.
Josh Moody is our guest now on First Person. Welcome, I'm Wayne Shepherd. Josh, originally from England, is pastoring in the Midwest, and you'll hear his story of faith and calling in a few moments. Thanks for joining us. We're thankful for the support of the Far East Broadcasting Company who make First Person possible each week. Last week, we told some stories from this international broadcasting ministry. If you missed them, you can go to our website, firstpersoninterview.com, to listen online. And look for the new podcast from FEBC. There's more information at febc.org. Around the country, there are several pastors of local churches who came originally from the UK. I'm thinking of Alistair Begg in Cleveland, Philip DeCourcy in Southern California. Well, another one is the pastor of College Church in Wheaton, Illinois. His name is Josh Moody, more about that name in a moment, and he's a scholar who counts Jonathan Edwards as one of his heroes. Let's meet Josh Moody now. As we connected online, I had to ask the obvious question if his name had anything to do with a famous Chicago evangelist from the past.
Yes, I've never been asked that question before, Wayne. Never.
I never before, yeah. Well, give me the standard answer, if you would.
Well, the short answer is there's no relation. The long answer is that, as far as I know, Moody's family originally came from an area of England called Somerset. And the side of my family, that is the Moody side of my family, also comes from Somerset. So it's reasonably likely that sometime back in the Middle Ages, there's some sort of genetic connection.
But I see.
There's certainly no lineal descendant.
Yeah, I understand. But you know I had to ask, right?
Yeah, I've been asked before. I gave you the long answer, you see. There you go.
All right. Well, growing up in London, though, were you aware of Moody and the Crusades back in his day?
My father is a big fan of D.L. Moody. I remember there's a book written by Pollock called Moody Without Sankey. Mm-hmm. He always had on his shelf, and I read many, many years ago. Of course, D.L. Moody had a huge influence on British evangelicalism.
Yes.
And so he was and is a hero figure.
Yes.
For British Christians.
Well, tell me about your life early on growing up in London, and was it a Christian family you grew up with?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I was very privileged and blessed. My parents are Christians. I grew up in the Church of England. And of course, the Church of England is a broad tent, as they say, and mm-hmm. there are lots of different kinds of Christians within the Church of England, the Anglican Communion. The part of that tribe, if you like that sort of nomenclature, that I grew up in is sort of John Stott, I suppose it will be familiar to many
sure.
listeners.
All Souls in London,
that,
yeah.
All Souls, that kind of Christianity. So Bible-believing, evangelistic, and Church of England in a sort of low church kind of evangelical sense.
Mm-hmm. When did it become personal, your faith in Christ?
Yeah, I think there were two moments when it happened to me. First, very young, when I was 8, my parents helped out at an evangelistic camp for teenagers, and they took us children along with them. And I remember one evening, I was put off to bed at 8 o'clock, and there was an evening meeting for all the teenagers where they would sing songs and there would be a sermon. And that evening was what I now know is called the Way Talk, which is there's an evening during that week of talks when there's an invitation for people to make a profession of faith. Well, I've been put to bed, but I never needed that much sleep, and I was probably restless, so I got out of bed and snuck down, despite all the admonitions to stay in bed, and snuck into the back of the meeting and heard the end of the talk given by a man called Clive Sampson, who I assume is now dead with the Lord. But he gave the talk and issued the invitation, and I prayed the prayer of faith and went back to bed. So I sometimes like to joke that my first profession of faith was an act of rebellion. But that was it. But then I really wrestled with forgiveness. I wrestled with a sense of assurance. I mean, I didn't use that language at the time, but mm-hmm. that's a sort of Puritan way of describing it. I just couldn't quite believe that I was really forgiven. And people would say to me things like, well, if you're not sure you've been forgiven, give your life to Jesus again. Perhaps you did it in pencil. Go over it again in pen. And I was forgive my life to Jesus over and over again. But I never could quite believe I'd been forgiven. And then there was a very special night one evening when I was 13, I think. I may have been 14, but I think I was just 13, at home late at night. And I was crying out to God, why haven't you forgiven me? Over and over again, I couldn't sleep. Why haven't you forgiven me? And then I heard a voice say, I have. Hmm. And that was the turning point in my life.
Wow. Was there any particular person early on, a mentor, one of your parents, I don't know, someone who really led you in the right path then?
Now, I suppose in those years, probably my parents. They would always read the Bible to me. As a teenager, there was a mini revival that took place at our boarding school. So I went, for the listeners, I went to a sort of classic English, it's called public school, but they're charitable institutions that have a long history, and they traditionally a boarding school. So I went off at the age of 13. I was sent off to school at a school that was founded in 1558 that my father went to, his father went to, both my brothers went to. And it had Christian foundations, very broadly speaking. But when I was there, there was very little Christian witness at all. There was a Christian Union meeting that was called the School Christian Union Meeting, and three people went to it, and it had a rather unfortunate acronym, SCUM, or scum. So I went along there, and very soon after I was there, in God's goodness, there was a revival, quite amazing. Not quite sure how it happened, but the chaplain at the time invited in a Fari evangelist to do the school chapels, and usually they were fairly sleepy affairs. Frankly, the chapels, 20 minutes of sort of traditional British religion, a good inoculation against the real thing. Mm-hmm. But this man came along, and he preached with fire and passion. Mm-hmm. And the week after, this Christian Union meeting had gone from 3 people to 103.
Wow.
And so I was very fortunate in that soon after that, some godly evangelical Christians who were involved at the time and then afterwards mentored me. I had a number of different godly mentors who encouraged me and taught me the shape of the gospel, how to read the Bible, how to do ministry. I was given a lot of leadership opportunities very young. I was leading this fledgling group of 100 teenagers for several years after that, I think one way or another, at least in leadership. And so I learned very soon the shape of the Christian faith and discipleship. Very early on, I think okay. My parents, but then soon afterwards, there was this sort of Christian revival and a lot of Christian teachers mentoring those who come to faith.
Okay. Well, I know you've lived in the U.S. for many years now and pastored at College Church in Wheaton, Illinois, but I noted in your biography you have some children. I have no idea how old they are, but do they really grasp your life growing up and understand the going to a English boarding school and all that? Do they understand that?
I suppose initially not really. We've tried to go back and every now and then and give them a sense of what England's like. I think they're in different sort of places. In some ways, I think some of them, well, I've got 4 children, and I think some of them feel a little third culture, if you're familiar with that mm-hmm. phrase. The missionaries, you don't really fit in either culture. I think some of them feel that a little bit.
Yeah.
I think the younger ones feel much more American. they're all born here. But I suppose we've become more American as we've been here, and probably the younger ones are more American. Mm-hmm. They're all American mm-hmm. citizens.
Tell me about your education in England.
After school, high school as it's called here, I then took a year off and traveled around Canada and America, and then I went up to Cambridge as an undergraduate. I studied history there. I ended up focusing on philosophy, particularly studying secular atheistic Enlightenment philosophy. And then I went and did some missionary work. And then I came back and did a PhD in theology at Cambridge again.
I don't know much about Cambridge, but it sounds like it might be a pretty rigorous academic environment. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You must have been pretty sharp.
Well, it's interesting. When I was young, I always felt I was the stupid one, frankly. But then you have to remember my father went to Cambridge, and one of my brothers went to Cambridge, and the other went to Oxford. So I think it was an unusually bright environment. But I didn't feel clever when I was younger at all. In fact, I was often at the bottom of the class. I had migraines quite badly, and I missed a week of school about every month for many years when I was younger. And I think that didn't help. And then actually, it was really when I got going as a Christian that my whole life began to change, and I started to think differently. I did much better. And I think I realized as I got older that I have a brain that's good at some things and not good at so other things. So the more specialized the education became, the easier I found it, strangely. When you have to be good at, I'm not very good at general knowledge, that sort of thing, you know, but there's certain areas of academic work that I seem to thrive in. And Cambridge is a rigorous environment, but I found it a very friendly environment. And they pick people not only for their intelligence, but for what I suppose they would call spark. And they try to give people the room to discover that spark.
Interesting.
So I actually found it quite a freeing place. It was, you go do it, and here's how we can help.
We'll continue to get to know Pastor Josh Moody and his connection with Jonathan Edwards in a moment on First Person.
1 year ago, I heard that one of FABC's radio stations aired in our province, so I started to listen.
Just one of millions of grateful people who listens to the Far East Broadcasting Company in her own language.
So many Kazakh people here like listening to your radio broadcast, and we feel like a family because of it. Thank you so much for broadcasting to our nation.
FEBC is dedicated to taking Christ to the world through radio and new media. To learn more, please visit febc.org. That's febc.org. My guest is Josh Moody, who is pastor of College Church in Wheaton, Illinois, and the speaker on the God-Centered Life radio program, God-Centered Ministries, and we'll put a link to that in our program notes here at firstpersoninterview.com. Josh, at some point, I know at least a part of your education took place on this side of the ocean. Talk about coming to America. Was it first to study?
Yeah, I was doing a PhD, as I said, I was doing a PhD in theology in England, and then the person I ended up studying with someone called Jonathan Edwards, and of course he's the famous great American thinker and preacher.
Yes,
perhaps the greatest American thinker ever. And I'd become fascinated by him for various reasons. And his manuscripts, of course, are in America, and they're kept at the Beinecke. Well, something like 90% of them are kept at the Beinecke Library at Yale.
I remember years ago reading a very extensive biography of Edwards, an amazing story of him as a pastor and a missionary, and just so you know him well. I mean, you've studied him, huh?
Spent many years studying him. Yeah, I started when I was a missionary. I took with me, you know, sort of a pair of socks and the complete works of Jonathan Edwards and nothing else, and nothing else to read. So I just read Edwards cover to cover. Very formative, absolutely brilliant. And there are lots of moments when I was sitting in libraries reading his sermons for academic work and just sensing I was meeting with the Lord and God was ministering to me. An extraordinary man of God, and not without failings, and I could talk about those too.
Yeah.
He did have real failings.
Yeah, I recall reading some of that. So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but would you consider Jonathan Edwards a mentor then to you?
I would say he's the most influential theological thinker for me. I mean, you know, who's dead, and there are living ones who have influenced me too, of course.
Right.
But you know, I put there Spurgeon, and people don't think of Spurgeon, you know, because Spurgeon famously didn't go off to university because the Lord said to him, "Seekest thou great things for yourself, seek them not," and he went off and preached.
Mm-hmm.
But Spurgeon was a genius, no doubt. And I found reading his sermons have been hugely theologically influential. We can sometimes kind of pillory Spurgeon as being, you know, a great orator, but not much of a thinker. And that's a huge mistake, I would say.
And we as evangelicals hear more about Spurgeon than we hear about Edwards. What do we miss about Jonathan Edwards that you would want us to know about this great man of the past?
For me, the thing that I think is key about Edwards is that he was able to assess the beginnings of what we would call secularization in the movement known as the Enlightenment and counter that with the gospel enlightenment. And there's been a real renewal of interest in Edwards in the last 20 years or so. Obviously, John Piper, you know, for evangelicals, but also at the academic level, ever since a scholar called Perry Miller became fascinated by him, there's been conferences and there are centers of studies of Jonathan Edwards all around the world, purely academic interest. Obviously, lots of Christians involved too. But I think the reason why he's regained such interest is because he was able to, as it were, refound our world, intellectually speaking, spiritually speaking, upon the gospel and counter the bad bits of the Enlightenment, affirm the good bits. And I would say we're still sort of schizophrenically wrestling with that. You have relativism, political correctness, all the woke stuff, which is a reaction to Enlightenment ideas. And but at the same time, you still have strong proponents, obviously, of science and rationalism and economics and all that, which is the Enlightenment agenda. And so we're still fighting the same issue. And I would say read Edwards because you'll discover a way of communicating the gospel to our day that falls into neither of those two binary extreme traps.
Fascinating. All we know is his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, but we misunderstand that sermon too, don't we?
Oh, yeah, and it's so out of context. I mean, he was obviously massively used by the Lord, that sermon, but preaching on hell was not unusual then. The reason why it sticks out for us is because people don't much preach on hell anymore,
true.
But
yeah.
It was common to preach on hell. It wasn't unusual to have a sermon on hell. Edwards' sermons, Charity and Its Fruits, all about 1 Corinthians 13, would be a counterbalance to that emphasis.
And somewhere I got the impression that when he gave that sermon, it wasn't in anger, it was with compassion that he gave that sermon.
Yes, I wrote about this for the anniversary of it. It's on some blog or other, but the context is Edwards had preached the sermon before, actually to very little effect. Almost, I mean, it was a sermon, you know, it was an Edwards sermon, so it was good.
It's one of those traveling sermons, huh?
it wasn't like a dramatic effect. Yes, it was, I suppose it was. He did re-preach his sermons. But then he was invited to preach at a place that was, revival was breaking out all over the locality at the time, but not in this town where he was asked to preach. And he actually wasn't the original preacher. He was the other guy who couldn't make it, and I don't think we know why. But he was so he was a stand-in, and he preached. He never actually finished the sermon in that time. He had to stop because people were under such great conviction.
Boy.
And people used to travel with a team. Pastors would travel with a team of people. So all the other pastors there got down among the people and started praying for them to help them. And that's really what was going on.
You mentioned in passing that you did live overseas, I think you said, before your PhD work. You lived in Georgia, the former Soviet Republic. What were you doing there, and how did that experience contribute to what you do now as a pastor?
It's actually massively influenced me. I suppose people know less about that than the sort of Edwards stuff, but it really has, because when I came back from the mission field, I realized it was blindingly obvious to me, in a way it never been, that the West was now in the mission situation. So we have to think contextualization. We're not shoring up Christendom, we're in a mission situation. I was there with a group called IFES, the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students, which is the mission arm of what in America is called InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And I was there setting up with a team to set up long-term indigenous Christian groups Tbilisi University, which is the university in the capital city of the Republic of Georgia. And then I also traveled down to Baku University in Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan's a nominally Muslim country, and Georgia is a nominally Christian country, Orthodox Christianity. And so that's what I was doing, but hugely influential, actually.
How would you compare Christianity in the States to, let's say, growing up in England?
Such a big place, America, isn't it? I mean, there's so many different kinds of things. And I think that's sometimes what, when you're a foreigner, it's hard to really grasp that. Americans tend to think of the English as one thing. And of course, they're not. There are many different things. And the English tend to think of the Americans as one thing. But of course, they're not. They're many different things. I remember listening to Billy Graham's, I think it was his last crusade in York, and I was listening on the radio because I couldn't get there. I wanted to hear it. I couldn't get down there, so I was listening to him. And I'd been in America a few years by then. And I listened to him, and suddenly I thought to myself, oh, he has a Southern accent. For me, before then, he'd just been American. You know, it was all the same thing. So I think there are so many different things. Obviously, proportionately, there are parts of the country in America where there are many more Christians by proportion. And that's a big difference. Christianity still has a much bigger influence in America.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge difference. There isn't in America the established church. So in England, the Church of England is, in the common mindset, is the church, and everything else is sort of defined by its relationship to the church. Well, we don't have that in America. I think in evangelicalism, it's interesting that the strongest parts of evangelicalism in England are quite intellectual and reasonably upper middle class. So the strongest Christian unions tend to be in the more elite university towns, and the weaker ones tend to be in the less elite university towns, and that's for historic strategic reasons. I think back in the 20s or something, the British evangelical movement decided to focus on winning the leaders, and that would influence the people. And so there's a huge investment in those big centers of influence. And I think American evangelicalism instead sort of, did do some of that, of course, but also set up other parallel institutions. You know, back in the 19th century, Wheaton College and all these other parallel institutions were set up when higher criticism and liberalism was beginning to make its way. So instead of, so that's a big difference too. So I think British evangelicalism is more intellectual. I remember when I read the famous Mark Knoll, The Scandal, The Evangelical Mind, not quite knowing what he was talking about, because my evangelical mentors had been, you know, had most of them had one degree from Cambridge or Oxford, not two. So it's like, what is he talking? I didn't get it. But you come out to America and you go, oh, okay, I see.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a big difference as well. And neither is better than the other. Obviously, we would have people who are wonderful at reaching the great masses of people, as well as people like Jim Packer. The body of Christ needs both.
That's Pastor Josh Moody of College Church in Wheaton, Illinois, our guest here on First Person. It was a pleasure getting to know Josh and about his passion for the gospel. In addition to being a pastor, Josh's radio ministry is called The God-Centered Life, and you can also listen to it online at the link we'll provide at firstpersoninterview.com. Today's interview and all of our past programs can be heard online at firstpersoninterview.com or subscribed to as a podcast at Apple Podcasts and many other podcast portals. A special word of thanks to the Far East Broadcasting Company for making these interviews possible. FEBC is observing its 75th year of ministry, reaching large parts of the world with gospel teaching and disciple-making programs. Learn more at febc.org. Now, with thanks to my friend and producer Joe Carlson, I'm Wayne Shepherd. Thanks for listening to First Person.